He was a morbidly obese surgeon destined for an operating table and an early death. Now he's a rebel MD who is fabulously fit and fighting to make America healthy again. This is Stay Off My Operating Table with Dr. Philip Ovadia.
Well, welcome back, folks. It is the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast with Dr. Philip Ovadia. I'm Jack Heald, and we are joined today by a man whose professional work is something I didn't even know existed until I started doing the research. So, as I've learned, Phil, from many of the guests you've found for the show, just because my first impression of, oh God, this is going to be boring, happens often. Most of the time, well, really all the time, I've been shocked at how interesting all of this is. So I'm really looking forward to this one. Introduce our guest.
Very good. I can guarantee you this one isn't going to be boring. This is a guest who I've wanted to have on actually for quite a while. Been fortunate to share the stage with him at a couple of events, and have really learned a lot from him about areas that I didn't even know I needed to know about, but that are really integral to our health. So very excited to have the illustrious, I'm going to say, Peter Ballastad with us today, known in many circles as the sod father. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Peter to give a little bit of his background to our audience. And I'm excited to get into this conversation.
Well, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Full disclosure, I've been given the title of Don Pedro, sod father of the Ruminati. So Now that we've been formally introduced, my background is I'm a forage agronomist and a ruminant nutritionist. I may have to come back and define those.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm glad you asked. Forages are those plants that are grown to be eaten by livestock. So you could think of them as pasture, hay, silage, grasses, clovers, other legumes, some non-leguminous forbs like, you know, amazingly enough, plantain is one that we can, or even members of the brassica family. We will plant specifically for livestock to eat.
The what family?
Brassicas, the cabbage family.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah. So so that's forages. Agronomy, those are the sciences to do with agricultural production, soils and plants. So forage agronomy, that's that. Ruminants are cows, sheep, goats, deer, buffalo, bison. There's a large number of these animals. They have the multi-compartmented stomach, with a population of microorganisms within the first part of that four-chambered stomach. And those are the organisms that actually digest the starch, the fiber. I was thinking one step ahead, the fiber in plant material. So cellulose is plant fiber. It's glucose units linked together in one specific way. But no vertebrate animal makes cellulase. So this most abundant carbohydrate in the biosphere is not utilizable by us. But all these microbes, free living.
I'm gonna stop you there. Translate that into English.
Well, okay. So photosynthesis.
Assume that. I don't know a whole lot of biology science.
Fair enough. So photosynthesis, how plants grow, is the process of capturing the energy from sunlight and converting it into chemical energy. That process takes CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere, water from the soil, produces oxygen as a byproduct, and carbohydrates, sugars, starches, okay? Those sugars get put together different ways. Glucose specifically gets put together one way. It makes cellulose, fiber, you know, wood, paper, cotton. Okay, you hook it together a different way and it makes starch. Same subunits, same glucose. You're just bonding them together differently. But because of the bond that makes cellulose, needs the enzyme cellulase to break it apart. Okay?
All right. With you so far.
But only microorganisms make cellulase.
Okay. And you said something about this most abundant form of carbohydrate on the planet.
Yep.
Vertebrates, which I think for our purposes, yep, we're talking about people.
Or you know, other mammals or birds or, yeah, exactly.
Okay. So the cellulose is, that's the plants we're talking about.
A large part. See, plant cells have walls. I mean, sorry, you know, you know, animal cells don't. They have membranes. So the cells.
I've never heard that.
Welcome to my world.
I've literally never heard that.
Welcome to my world.
Plant cells have walls. Animal cells have membranes.
Yeah. Yeah. Plant cells are rigid, right?
That's why I love this show.
Yeah. Yeah. So these microorganisms breaking down fiber then produce compounds that the cow or the sheep or what the host ruminant can then absorb. So they are this key link in the energy cycle, sunlight through plants to ruminants, then to us or other carnivores or scavengers, what have you. So the ruminants are critical links in the food supply. They're critical in all of the ecosystems in which they exist, and they exist from the Arctic through the tropics. So in desert biomes, you can find them everywhere. And not surprisingly, they're the largest group of domesticated animals that we've found a way to bring into our sphere of influence. So, you know, it's kind of tricky to domesticate a carnivore.
It's almost like, you know, perhaps millions of years of evolution and or, you know, depending on your beliefs, the system was created this way. And for us to try and fight that might not be the most intelligent thing to do.
Yeah, indeed. So I think it was Dr. Jessica Thompson gave a presentation, and she was describing the human predatory pattern, you know, the thing that makes humans unique among existing primates is we are the only existing primate that routinely kills and consumes animals larger than ourselves. Like chimps will kill other animals, but they tend to be smaller. And so, and then she described, you know, way back when you look at some of the Homo ancestors that were functioning as scavengers, you find long bones with marrow in them. And if the bone is intact, the marrow is protected from the environment. And so this clever little hominid came along and figured out with a rock, I can break this apart and get this really rich source of nutrition. She described it like finding a stick of butter in a landscape devoid of fat. Well, think about a grassland, which is where we're from. Long enough ago, maybe you could find some small amount of seasonally available carbohydrate, some berries or fruit, or maybe seeds from grasses or trees, nuts. But that was not a regular food supply. And so what was regularly available were the remains of kills of other of carnivores, and then given enough time, we developed the ability to hunt cooperatively. And so then we began consuming animal source products from outside the bones, so muscle, viscera, and that led to changes in us, relative to other primates. So all of that gets me away from my training, but it does reinforce the idea that, as I say, humanity's roots are in the grasslands and our future will be there too.
So going back to your training and your education, what were you intending to kind of do with this? It's obviously not a, you don't get too many middle school and high school students saying that they want to go into forage agronomy. What kind of led you down that pathway, and what were your plans for when you completed your education?
Well, I wish I could say I had a really concerted plan when I started, but that's just not the case. I grew up in suburban Philadelphia, Lower Bucks County, Pennsylvania. That area had already been converted from farmland to, housing tracts. But as I went along, ended up through a long story in taking some agriculture classes. And that introduced me to this reality, and I was fascinated. And then I ended up transferring from upstate New York, University of Georgia, finished degree, did another degree, was thinking about another project in a different, at University of Kentucky. But before I got there, I was blessed enough to take a course in pasture ecology. And that completely changed what I wanted to do. And I was able to still at University of Kentucky work under a different professor and look at that. What I ended up doing after graduation was coming to the University of Oregon. Coming to Oregon State University. Oh, and not that other one south of us. No. And I was the forage extension specialist there. And so I functioned in that space until 92 and left the university, did some work for some other things, including a large stint at Hewlett-Packard. I joke about their agronomic division.
Well, no, well known for their work in agriculture.
Yeah, not. It let me stay in this community where we were living. And so since 86, we've lived in the same house, which is kind of unique.
That's impressive.
2011, I managed to get back into agriculture working in the forage seed industry. And was able to do that. And they allowed me to talk to metabolic health community events, as well as going to beef and dairy and grassland meetings and talk to them about metabolic health. So I've been trying to be this bridge builder between those two primary communities of mine. I've served in the leadership of a national forage and grassland council. I'm on several international and national projects, and I'm really quite interested in what needs to be done and could be done in this country, but also overseas, because one of my lines is that humanity's existential crisis is insufficient animal source food in their diet.
That's not going to make you a lot of friends in certain communities. I'd like to follow that trail, but the one I think we should start with is it's not a blindingly clear connection between ruminant, whatever the other word was that you did, and metabolic health. I know there's a connection, but you kind of made a leap there, and you got to close that gap for us.
I will get to that in just a second, but I do want to share that I remember way back at University of Georgia, we had this emeritus professor. He was a nutritionist. And he was trying to talk to us and saying, now what they're saying, and this would be in the early 80s, and he was saying, they don't quite have it right. And all us young people were like, oh, what do you know? He's emeritus. He should have. I wish I could make amends to him. He was trying to warn us in the best way that he could at the time. So what happened to me is what happens to many, right? I had a personal health experience. In 2007, I was a 51-year-old balding, obese, pre-diabetic. Today, I'm just balding. You know, it's a powerful therapeutic, but it's not a miracle. You know, it'll do many things.
I can attest.
Can I get an amen, brother?
Amen.
Yeah.
So, you know, that the 2007, if you can think back to the landmark times, Gary, you know, good calories, bad calories was about to come out. You know, there were blogs and things online. Protein Power was, Life Plan was out, I believe. But I think I read Protein Power first. By this point, my wife was already 5 years onto this journey, and she was smart enough to go, this is what I want to eat. What would you like to eat? And so I kind of fumbled around until I finally said, you know, what I'm doing ain't working. What are you doing? And so that got me started. After reading Good Calories, Bad Calories, my initial reaction was to get mad because the industries that I was trained to serve had been unfairly, in my perspective, demonized, right? Slandered. They were the cause of all this chronic disease that we were seeing. We needed to eat less of the products of ruminant animal agriculture, full fat dairy, meat. And then, of course, there's the environmental question that comes in. So I started in 2010 to just kind of talk about what I was learning about the metabolic health message. And I was also starting to show up at some of these events and, as I say, stalk some of the speakers at metabolic health conferences. I remember going to one in Seattle, which is 5 hours away from me. It was a joint meeting of the Nutrition Metabolism Society and the American Society of Bariatric Physicians. So I got to meet Eric Westman for the first time. You know, Michael Eads was there. I got to see Gary Taubes in person. I think I met Finney there, Steve Finney there. There were a bunch of others that I met, including Adele Height, and that's a story we could talk about. So I had been out of agriculture for a long time, and they had this thing where they wanted you to identify yourself by name, location, specialty, if you got up to the mic to ask questions. The first dude up was somebody who had two talks, and he shouldn't have had one by my perspective. He's just a bad presenter. And then his topic was impediments to better drugs for weight loss. Okay. I'm not a pharmacist. I'm not a human health, but he didn't do a good job. And so he gets done and there's time for questions. And I look and there's a microphone just right over there at the end of my table and nobody's at it. And I'm going like, okay. So I get up and play Stump the Speaker, which I hadn't done for years. And played with him for a little while. And what happened as a result of that was, and I identified myself as a forage agronomist, which went over about as well as it did when we started. and that led to a series of questions throughout the rest of this 3-day conference, where I had these wonderful conversations with people. And that showed me that I knew things from my training that people in the medical realm would like to know. Right. And so I've been trying to do that ever since.
So there was a bit of kismet there. It was just the right background and the right moment all coming together.
Mm-hmm. And I can certainly attest that as little as nutrition comes up in medical school, forage agronomy is even lower on that list of what doesn't get taught in medical school, but probably should these days. So, the magic ruminant animal, which is now how I refer to them, and many of the ranchers that I have spoken to, and I may have even heard you say this as well, but many of the ranchers identify themselves as grass farmers, and their job is basically to grow good grass for these ruminant animals to work their magic on, or grasses, I should say, forage in general. So talk to us a little bit about you know, what it is about the grass, the soil, the whole kind of ecosystem that then translates into the benefits that humans are going to get then from eating those ruminant animals.
Wow. Okay. So the vast majority of what has been turned into agricultural land now worldwide was grassland to begin with. So think the, you know, Corn Belt, think Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, that was tall grass prairie. It had been in place for millennia. You had large herds of migratory animals. You had people who were managing those animals on the grasslands. The sod was so thick, they built homes out of it. The sod was so thick that the plows they had wouldn't work. They had to invent a steel plow, an iron plow that would cut. And they said the sound of it cutting the roots made a sound like the ripping of cloth. And that's what protected this resource of topsoil. And top, you know, soil is that most precious thin layer between bare rock and air that allows all life on Earth, well, let's at least say terrestrial life, although I think we could make a case for aquatic life as well, enables it, right? Because that's where we have nutrient cycling. That's where we have water being held. So plants then can colonize that space. So grasses, you know, we tend to have perennials. So these are plants that live for multiple years, as opposed to annuals that only live one season. So they tend to establish and live for long periods of time. Over these millennia, these communities of plants evolve. And so plants adapt to the environment that they're in, and they can withstand drought or periodic fire or this grazing pressure. In any case, we're still taking nutrients out of the soil, and CO2 from the atmosphere. We're forming this material that for humans has very little food value. But when a ruminant animal eats it, the microbes in its rumen take that high fiber food and convert the fiber into small volatile fatty acids, small chain volatile fatty acids. So if I take grass and I dry it down, I might have 3-4% ether extract, call that crude fat. Okay. And it might have a nitrogen percent somewhere in the 3-4% range. It's going to have some minerals in it. But mostly it's going to be this fiber. I feed it to a ruminant animal as a complete diet, and the animal then ends up digesting 70 to 80% of its energy coming from the fat that was produced by the microbes that were breaking down the fiber. So the microbes are making all this fat that the animal can absorb. They're also taking whatever nitrogen was in the feed, and they're building microbial protein out of it, which then in the acidic stomach, the host animal digests. And so the end result is that there's no such thing as an essential amino acid in a ruminant's diet. Essentially, there's no such thing as an essential fatty acid in a ruminant's diet.
They produce it themselves.
Exactly. Or the microbes do, and then they take it, and then they build up from there.
The fact that I do not have a chemistry degree is going to show itself here, but I'm kind of blown away that these microbes can produce fat out of grass.
Yes.
I realize intellectually, I understand it's all just chemicals down at the base, but the fact that there's organisms that can turn grass into fat and protein, that just kind of blows my mind.
Well,
I realize it's very obvious, but
let's line those up. Human beings have essential amino acids in their diet, right?
Yeah.
And they have essential fatty acids in their diet. Ruminants don't. There's no such thing as an essential carbohydrate in a human's diet. A ruminant has two forms that are required for its health. It has to have both cell wall and the carbohydrates that come in cell contents. So that would be sugar and starch and related compounds. You have to have both of those for the ruminant to function properly. So here you have these two organisms that live with non-competitive essential macronutrients. I just
almost
find
like
that
it's
wonderful.
A symbiotic relationship.
Almost, yeah, you know. So you have that taking place. You have the reality that across the world today, all of the feed that goes into feeding all of the domesticated ruminant animals, okay, 96% of that total is not human edible. And it's actually a little bit more than that, but we don't need to quibble.
Yeah,
we can say 96%. Something like 40% of all of the livestock feed. See, that I've heard this said, but 40% of what's fed to livestock is waste from making people food. So when we process edible crops into some food product, we produce a lot of waste. If I grow corn or I grow wheat, over half of the biomass in that crop, so the above ground crop, over half of that is not human edible. But I can feed it to a ruminant. And I would argue we're better off feeding the crop to the ruminant, but that's a different thing. So now we've got the essential amino acids being provided in their most digestible form in their proper ratio for human health and flourishing. So we start with a product that's low in protein quality, poor protein quality, high in fiber, low in fat. We feed it through a ruminant animal and we end up with highest quality, nutriently speaking, foods for human use. At the same time, in various parts of the world, something like over half of the nitrogen fertilizer that's used to grow human edible crops is coming from manure. Okay, so if people want to get rid of livestock, then you've got to replace a significant amount of fertilizer. Over half of the world's farmers still depend on draft animals. You know, animals to haul carts or equipment or you know, run around in circles to power things. So if you're going to get rid of livestock, what are you going to do to replace that? Of course, we don't just get meat and milk from livestock. We get a lot of other products that are used, leather, you know, pharmaceuticals, all sorts of things. It's a significant source of livelihood for like 750,000 of the world's poorest are herders or pastoralists. You know, we have these animals as a source of wealth in various places. So it's generating new wealth. You know, you're creating this from existing resources. And so if I have an animal grazing out in a field, like 90% of what it consumes nutrient-wise ends up back on the field. So you end up with this cycling of nutrients. And then when I ship that product to somewhere else, it ends up removing less than when I crop the field. And if I just look at something like phosphorus content, for example, but other nutrients as well, I'm providing it to the consumer in the most utilizable form. So specifically for phosphorus, the vast majority of the phosphorus in seeds, nuts, and legumes is not human utilizable because it's in phytate. And again, we don't produce phytase. So it ends up then as, you know, an environmental pollutant in the waste system, right? Because it,
right.
So maybe as we think more holistically about food systems and sustainable societies, we ought to think about what form we're providing the nutrients in the next 30, what years, you know, by 2050, 26 years, good Lord. 70 some percent of humanity is going to live in urban areas. So we're going to be shipping food from where it's produced to where the majority of humanity lives. This might be a consideration for people to think about. So there's a whole range of interest in something that's come to be called soil health. Soil conservation has been an interest certainly since the 30s in the United States, when we had the Dust Bowl, which came as the result of favoring the production of wheat in an area of short grass prairie that shouldn't have been plowed, but I digest. So this, we're finding out that in order to protect the soil, we need to keep growing plants on that soil for as much of the year as we can. We need a variety of plants growing, so we have different roots in the soil exploiting different layers. We need to limit plowing or cultivation, soil disturbance. And we're finding that when we introduce grazing animals, those benefits are increased. And so we've had this pattern of specialization in North America, where we went from mixed farms to I grow corn,
right,
or, you know, I'm a cattleman. So you asked about the grass farming. There's a mindset difference that people who focus on, as you said so well, the grass is my crop, but it doesn't, well, Oregon's different. I need to be careful. This kind of grass doesn't have a sale market value. Right. There's a story about sitting at my table. The company I used to work for, they had a tagline on hats that said, "Got grass?" question mark. And one day I was sitting there doing some work and there was a knock on the door and the county sheriff was saying, "Some dog is reported loose. Do you know whose dog this is?" And he was looking at me kind of funny and I didn't know why until I sat down and go, "Oh, wow, I've got the hat on." In any case, we're using the animals to manage that resource as well as to convert it into a saleable product, which had, you know, then I have some value for that. And so, you know, the cow's job is to harvest. The cow's job is to provide a live, unassisted birth. You know, every year I want her to wean a live calf, you know, that's her job. My job is to make sure she's got the resources she needs to do that. It's one way I've heard it expressed. And so the management of the grass system requires, in many cases, people to step away from thinking of themselves as I'm a cattleman or I'm a sheep man or I'm a dairy man. And in other countries, that has happened sort of organically because that's how their systems developed. Think of New Zealand. They're very conscious of the grass base of their industry. In this country, because we had different resources in different situations, not so much. And it is one of the things that we need to get people more aware of.
So can we kind of get down to brass tacks? You've given us a lot of facts that I'm sure are fairly inarguable, but let's convert it into what does that mean for us today? What are we, what is the the myths that are floating around in the atmosphere that people have just uncritically accepted as true, that are blatantly false. What do we do differently? What's your prescription?
Okay. So yeah, several, and you mentioned air. So let's hit that one first. Cows are not destroying the planet. We can come back to that. Humanity's diet is already plant-based. Going further into a plant-based diet will not improve the health of any population. I am advocating that all populations need to eat more animal source food, not less. High, medium, low-income countries. I think it was Cordain and colleagues in 2000 surveyed existing hunter-gatherer societies and said, you know, how many calories are you getting from plants? How many calories are you getting from animals? And they came up with ranges from 100% animal source food to a minimum of 30%. And 30 was really a tail. It was really low down. The mean was somewhere around 70. Okay, percent of calories coming from animal source food. U.S. is 29. In 2020, wow. Some Nordhagen and colleagues published a paper stating that when populations go below 30% of calories from animal source foods, they see multiple rapidly increasing deficiencies in micronutrients. And then View and colleagues in 2022 said that if you're not getting at least half of your protein from animal source protein, you're probably not meeting your non-protein nutrient requirements.
If you're not getting half your
protein,
nutrition,
your protein,
your protein
from
animal
sources,
proteins, from animal sources, you're not getting the other stuff you need from any source. Did I translate that
from
correctly?
From that diet. Yeah, you're not meeting your requirements for these other nutrients from that diet.
No matter what else you're doing.
Right. So, you know, we're in this highly processed, plant-heavy diet in the U.S., let alone other countries. Okay. So those are things that make me go, wow, we really need to find a way to increase the productivity and efficiency of ruminant animal agriculture globally. And it's got to look different for a number of reasons, right? And it's got to be done in a way that protects or even enhances the environment in which it takes place. It's not going to merely be animal science and agronomy. There's a lot of politics and other things that are involved, but people have to get that vision, because right now there's these competing visions that say, oh, we eat too much.
Yeah.
Right? You can still find people who are saying obesity is overnutrition. I mean, they describe it that way, as opposed to thinking of it as a manifestation of metabolic illness, which is produced by malnutrition, right? And so getting people to understand this is really critical. And that's one of the things that I want to find people to help me bring that message into these, I'm thinking, largely well-meaning, sincere, educated groups of people that are talking this way. So let's have those conversations until we find out different. So we have to have these animal source foods. Ruminant animal production offers ecological advantages over monogastric animal source food production. I'm not anti-pork. I'm not anti-chicken or poultry or fish. I'm just saying. And there was a paper recently that said if you would switch animal source food from 12% replacement of ruminant products, replacing monogastric products. So let's say switch out 12% of your pork for beef globally, you would end up with a significant reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, plus you'd free up resources to feed 500,000 people. No,
but
not half a billion. Sorry.
But the macro trends are actually going in the other direction. Exactly. Our consumption of monogastric animals like chicken primarily, has been increasing while our ruminant consumption, particularly beef, has been decreasing, at least here in the U.S. over the past, half century or so.
Sure. And there's many reasons for that, but not the least is the reason to avoid red meat. Right. I mean, price is a problem. Absolutely. But and convenience is another problem, but all of those are addressable. But you have to kind of get at that underlying mythology that led us to think that, red meat was a health hazard, that animal fat caused heart disease, that, animal protein will melt your kidneys. I don't know. But so it's important for us to look at that. We have people who look at land use and they say, if we weren't using all this land to raise livestock, then we could grow this much more food. There's a couple errors in that thinking. Number one is not all land that we run livestock on is suitable for producing human edible crops, right? The example I use is a soccer field. And if you think of the area within the overall boundary as the land area of the world, then if you think of the agricultural land, it would only go from one goal line. It wouldn't even reach the close edge of the center circle. So significantly less than half is agricultural land. If you think of the land that's suitable for tillage, we call it arable land. That would only go from the goal line to the penalty spot within that 18-yard penalty area. That's how much less arable land there is than agricultural land. So arable land is agricultural land, but not all agricultural land is arable. Okay.
Right.
So, there are other things that need to be brought in. For every 4 pounds of vegan food, they produce a pound. For every pound of vegan food, they produce 4 pounds of byproducts. Inedible biomass. So upcycling that through livestock is a really good idea. We have in the Nebraska area, a whole lot of cornfields get grazed by cattle in the wintertime or fall and winter. So they're using that leftover crop material as a feed resource. You have people in the southern plains grazing winter wheat pastures and at some point saying, do I want a wheat crop or not? And if they do, then they take the animals off at a certain time. And if they don't, they just graze it until it's dead. Here in Western Oregon, we grow a lot of grass seed. And so you'll see a lot of sheep running on the seed fields in the wintertime to keep that biomass down, the grass mowed down essentially. So now we have this integration, the multiple use of a piece of land in one season, right? So people too often think of this either or thing, and it's right. Far more complicated. If we look at water, greenhouse gas emissions, first of all, there was a study that was released years ago that dramatically overstated. It was retracted by its own authors, but it doesn't matter. It's one of those zombie myths that's out there. And,
a lie makes it halfway around the world before the truth has got its boots on.
There you go. So I've already described the photosynthetic cycling of carbon. So let's now plug the cow into that. So we've formed this carbohydrate from CO2, we haven't, the plants did. Right. And some portion of that carbohydrate gets burped out as methane. Okay. That methane in the atmosphere within 10 years gets oxidized to CO2. So the CO2 goes through the plant, becomes carbohydrate, goes to the cow, methane is emitted, gets oxidized in 10 years. Now we're back to the same CO2 that went in. So what that means is if we can keep livestock numbers constant, there is no warming contribution. Contrast that with use of fossil fuels or extraction of them, seeps from natural sources, what have you. So that when that methane is oxidized, now you have a relatively new CO2 molecule in the atmosphere. You're building up CO2, but people aren't talking about this properly. So what I found over time is that all of the concerns can be addressed, but that gets us back to the point where I would, you know, look to somebody from the medical field and say, if it's true that eating a diet high in animal source food can reverse or halt or whatever the appropriate description is, this constellation of metabolic illness, which is the driver of chronic illness, which is the driver of healthcare, and is bankrupting the nation and the world. Okay, what's its environmental footprint? What's it? So anytime we talk about sustainability, we have to talk about economic and societal factors as well as environmental factors. And too often the environmental just gets boiled down to just greenhouse gas emissions. Right. So we only focus on that one thing out of a group, which is only one of at least three groups. So we oversimplify the conversation, but we can go and find the estimate that said that the U.S. healthcare industry is a source of significant pollution, including 10% of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., 10, 10.
Can be traced directly to the U.S. healthcare industry?
That was what the paper said in its estimate.
Wow.
Now the EPA puts out a sources and sinks budget. And so they bucket things differently. So it's not going to be an apples to apples comparison, but just to give you an idea of what's going on. Land use change is the bucket in which agriculture goes along with forestry. That comes in somewhere in the 11% range of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. Okay, that's all of it. Animal agriculture is 4%. Beef is 2%. Okay, so that's what the EPA says. At the same time, they estimate that already today, the land, forestry and agriculture is sequestering an amount of carbon equal to 12% of the total.
So it's a net
negative already today.
Consumer of CO2.
It is, yes. That's a good consumer. So they're talking about sequestration.
Right.
And so as they get down in the weeds, they don't talk about the biomass that stays on the surface that's going to rot in a year or something. I mean, they tend to think a little longer term than that. So when they did the healthcare estimate, they said, how much food do hospitals serve? You know, how much power do they use? How much transportation is involved, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how they came up with their number. So EPA, you know, buckets transportation and energy and industry, and they do it differently. So I want to be clear, it's not an apples to apples. The point is that it's there, it's a significant contributor. And we don't talk about it, except typically it's with the, well, if they just eat the way the, you know, dietary guidelines recommends, then everybody be healthier. And so that would make healthcare more sustainable. Okay. I would argue that.
Yeah, we've already
been. Yeah, that's never actually been demonstrated to be true, but we want to believe it to be true.
Well, in fact, if I read the dietary guidelines, they will say something like, for the last three editions, there's been words, something to the effect of not intended for the treatment of disease. So this agronomist translates that to eat this way, you won't get sick. But if you get sick, don't eat this way.
Exactly.
Okay. Somebody else did a study of the pharmaceutical industry, and they said that they were a higher intensity emitter than the automotive industry, with greater variation across the industry than the automotive. Okay. So somebody else took those figures and they did the calculations, and they said, at the end of their estimate, they said, if the average adult American with type 2 diabetes could eliminate their medication use, they would lower their carbon footprint 29% more than if they shifted from a high meat to a vegan diet.
One more time.
If the average adult American with type 2 diabetes could eliminate their medication use. Let's just speculate wildly that such a thing would even be possible.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, that's sarcasm, right? Okay. So if that were achieved, they would end up lowering their carbon footprint 29% more than if they shifted from a high meat to a vegan diet. And they have to stay on that diet for the rest of their life. That's always the assumption in all these conversations, sure, right? Sure. And how many people stay on a... Okay, so we have that suggestion. And then we can think of what is the societal impact of people's lives being diminished by chronic disease, shortened lifespan, shortened health span? You know, what's the productivity losses? The generational issues of, you know, dying sooner than you need to die. Yeah. So all of those, I think, can be built into a compelling picture of we need to be providing the human population a higher quality diet, higher plane of nutrition than it's currently being offered. And we can do this. And it isn't even a scientific issue. This is the part where I just start pulling out what's left of my hair. It isn't a scientific issue. It's a political issue. There are other issues at play here, and we have to get good at playing those games. But it's not, science didn't get us here. So it's hard to imagine science being the solution at this point. And many of these things, I can go to my textbooks and pull them off and chapter and verse. And they're, well, okay, you want to argue with me? Don't argue with me. Argue, you know, it's, but in any case, how's that working for you? Is the question I learned to ask, right? So if you think that you can reverse your type 2 diabetes or metabolic syndrome following a vegan diet, I am all for you. Go forth. And I hope that you learn some better metrics to measure, because I'm pretty convinced we haven't been given those until relatively recently. I would be concerned if you're trying to make a little human or raise a human. I'm reasonably certain that when you get to old fart stage like me, that you can't do that because we get less efficient at utilizing nutrients. So we need an even higher quality diet than, say, a middle-aged, 20 or 30 year old man would need. Now, a woman, that would be different. She needs a higher quality diet, especially if she's going to try to make little human beings. But I mean, a fifth of children, of women of childbearing age in the US and UK are anemic. 20%.
Wow.
If I look globally, somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of children, five and under, are stunted. This is not only stature, it's also brain development.
Yeah.
And this is acknowledged to come from a lack of the essential nutrients required for proper development that are best or solely provided by animal source foods. This is a shame, and this is a scandal. It also, their diet aligns very well with what Eat Lancet recommends as a planetary diet. So the diet that we can see from looking at country data and looking at a map, we can see that the diet they recommend is the diet associated with the highest rate of stunting and the highest rate of mortality. And that's what they're recommending for human and planetary health, except when they're challenged, they admit that neither one of those is true. Details. It's a great story.
So one might almost come to think that maybe human health isn't their primary interest.
Perhaps. Yeah. You know, misanthrope is a word that I think, you know, anti-human. There's a long history of people who see humans as the problem. And, yeah. You know, one of the points that I, you know, imagine 9 billion human brains properly nourished, communicating and cooperating. What problems don't you think they could solve? I think we have a really hopeful message. And that's part of what motivates me as well. You know, when you see what it could be and what has been demonstrated, I mean, you know, the studies where they just intervene by giving school children one egg a day so WHO says that the best source of essential nutrients for children 6 months to 24 months of age is meat, eggs, dairy, seafood. That's what WHO says. Hello, Professor Noakes.
Wow.
UNICEF says that 60% of children, 60% of children, 6 months to 24 months of age do not get meat, eggs, dairy, seafood.
At all.
That's what they say. So, you know, part of me says, you know, whatever the rich Europeans want to do, you know, the people that were born on third base and think they hit a triple, fine, whatever. Let's go solve some problems here, which we can do. But unfortunately, a lot of what the third base dwellers have instituted ripples down into the low and middle income countries. It influences policy. It influences lending. It influences what they can do to develop their resources. It's a modern day imperialism. Yeah. And I think that's a shame and a scandal as well. But I digest. Let's get back to the topic.
it's a little frustrating that the topic of how to be healthy, how to get healthy, stay healthy, raise healthy children, ends up in the realm of politics. It's mm-hmm. a kind of insanity that drives me nuts.
Mm. Well, for me, it was a short commute. I was already in the neighborhood. So, but how do we... So again, back to the medical message. How many people even know that diabetes is reversible? Or do they believe it's chronic, progressive, incurable? Do they know the link between insulin resistance and heart disease? You know, all of these, for me, the mental health aspect, and again, we're now way out beyond the edge of my expertise, but I just find so much hope in this idea that many other researchers are bringing forward. So how many people know this? We need to get that better known. And then you're left with the decision, this is crude and sometimes I can't help myself. But if it comes down to it, are you telling me that you're more concerned about what might happen to the Earth in 2100 than you are about dying with all the toes you were born with? Really? Because I value your life more than you do, apparently. So what can we do to help you understand that that's what's going on here? You know, the idea of women struggling with infertility and that being, you know, insulin resistance. And you think about what people are willing to go through, expense and trauma and all that. And it could be diet related.
Yeah.
And why is that not the first thing offered? When now I'm just an agronomist, I don't know, but I sit in audiences and I listen to stories about people who say to their patients who are of childbearing age, if you do not want to become pregnant and you're not on contraception, you should get on contraception before you start this diet. Because it reverses so quickly that people get surprised. And then there's the physician that I listened to. She grew up in Mozambique. She was educated in Canada. She went back to Mozambique. She wanted to practice, couldn't. So she opened her own clinic. She was working with women. Women were very happy. But then she heard that there were women in the community saying, don't go to her. She'll get you pregnant. Because you had 30-some-year-old women who thought they were done having children weren't necessarily upset with that idea and found out that they weren't, because this condition was addressed so quickly. And my experience in talking to my colleagues and the producers that I was trained to serve and the communities I was trained to serve, they don't know this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, why did it have to be a forage agronomist that brought you this news? Well, you know, what's up here? I don't get it. So I think that that's something that we can push. In Las Vegas next week, I have a proposal to get people involved. But let's see what we can all do to multiply the personal experience. I mean, Doc, that's what happened for you, right? How did you first hear about therapeutic carbohydrate reduction as a approach?
Yeah, so my introduction to it was through Gary Taubes. But I have oftentimes commented, how much I've learned from the engineers and computer scientists. And now I'm going to add to that and the forage agronomists about, you know, heart disease that I didn't learn from my medical colleagues. So I think we certainly need to continue spreading this message. And, you know, I am encouraged, as I know you are, in seeing the growth and seeing, you know, how the message has spread over, you know, the past just few years. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I, like you, believe that humanity does have the power to solve this and will solve this. And we just have to start paying attention to the obvious information that's in front of us is the way that I look at it. And the harder, the more effort that it takes from politicians and such to convince us about the other, take on this, I guess you could say, the more obvious it becomes what a false, you know, argument they're putting forward. Mm-hmm. So I think, thanks to, your leadership, thanks to so many others, we are getting there and we are starting to turn the ship around. And I think ultimately we're going to continue to do so.
This has been so, I literally learned something that I can't believe I've never, ever heard before about the difference between animal cells and plant cells. But more than that, just looking at the whole issue of metabolic health from the standpoint of where these ruminants, cows and such, live inside this circle of life where we all dwell, and how they contribute and help keep us healthy, and we help keep them healthy. It's been great stuff, and I suspected it would be. But thanks for following through, Peter. Thanks for keeping me intrigued rather than bored. It's just amazing.
Well, I'm so glad to have the opportunity. It's nice to spend some time. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to do that in person over some coffee sometime. And yeah, keep in touch. If anyone has questions, I share references. I make introductions. I'll close with one thing. There's a meat scientist. Did you know that there is such a thing as meat science?
Well, there's a meat scientist. Forage agronomy, so you know.
he's at North Dakota State University. He formulated a diet for growing pigs to emulate what N. Haynes says the macronutrient composition of the U.S. diet is. The attending veterinarian stopped it early because it was inhumane.
Mm. Wow. Did you hear that, folks?
Yeah.
Did you hear that? It's inhumane to feed pigs the diet that the average American lives on. It's inhumane. Wow. All right. Let's talk about how folks can learn more.
I'm all over social media. If you find another Ballerstedt out there, he probably can let me know, because I don't know about him. There's not that many of us. You can find me grass-based on Twitter and on Instagram. That's one word. You can find me on Facebook by name. I also have a grass-based health page. You can find ruminati.substack.com and lots of videos on YouTube. And my email is peter.ballerstedt.
No, don't give out. Don't give out email. Don't do that. Okay. Bad plan.
Bad plan. Okay. We won't do that then.
Yeah. If people really want to find you, they can do all the other stuff and end up with the email. All right. Well, we'll make sure all that contact information shows up in the show notes. So, folks, this has been the very first ruminant agronomist we've had. And quite possibly maybe the only one in the world.
Oh, no, I can introduce you to lots.
But also a metabolic health specialist.
Yeah, so, okay.
Very good. Very good. Phil, close it out for us, man.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. And certainly look forward to, again, sharing a cup of coffee and a steak with you sometime soon. And maybe we'll continue this conversation with the round two sometime in the future.
I would welcome that. And if I can do anything to help you alleviate people's concerns, please don't hesitate to contact me.
That's fantastic. Well, for Dr. Philip Ovadia and Peter Ballerstedt, this has been the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. And we will talk to y'all next time.
Chances are you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't need to change your life and get healthier. So take action right now. Book a call with Dr. Ovadia's team. One small step in the right direction is all it takes to get started. Contact us at ifixhearts.com/talk. That's ifixhearts.com/talk.